Oh, good morning, Mosaic Church. Brothers and sisters, right? Brothers and sisters, or last week we learned just bros. Yeah? Yeah, last week we got some insight into the NRST, the new Renault Standard Translation, and we got a word that was added. It's the word bros, and it's actually really helpful. So I wanted to do a little like research into this word for us this morning. I think it's going to be helpful as we move forward. So I made us a little slide that gives us the etymology of this word. I just want to know where it came from and where it's going. So, back in the mid 16th century, what happened is writers shortened the word brother to bro. And this lasted for a few different centuries till we got to the mid 19th century. Mid 19th century, this word became short for bromo sapien. And what that is a human being that's a male that's your friend, right? A bromo sapien. There's a lot of different variations of this. You got a bro hug, right? You do this with your bro, right? Your bromo sapien. You clap and you grasp and you pull in and you bring the other hand around and you tap twice, right? That's a bro hug. Over here, we got bro Jackson. That's your buddy that's good at everything, right? That's your bro that's good at everything. Bro Jackson. You got Broda. That's your buddy who just has lots of wisdom just flowing from them. That's your broda. You've got broast. This is what you do when you make a toast with a fellow brother, right? You've got someone who's ambrodextrous. It's someone who can do the shaka sign with both hands at the same time. I would be ambrodextrous. And then broasis. Broasis is the place that you go with your bros to hang out. It's preferable that there's a dartboard, that there's a pool table and a ping pong table at a broasis. But it doesn't have to be. Right? So this would be your brocabulary. This is how you understand what happened in the mid-19th century. Now, we made a giant leap in the vocabulary, in the etymology of bro last week, right? In circa 2024, Hope Vanderit gave us just another person in close relationship. It could be a male, could be a female, could be a parent, could be a child, just anybody in that close relationship. And just kind of, if you want to use it in a sentence, it would be like, bro, bro, come on, bro. Now, all jokes aside, this is actually really helpful. What you'll find in different translations, there are strengths and there's weaknesses in any given translation. And in the English Standard Version, oftentimes in the New Testament, particularly in the letters, when you see the word brothers, it's the Greek word adelphoi, which can mean male siblings, but it can also mean any sibling, a male or female sibling. And most of the time in the New Testament, when you see the word brothers, it means brothers and sisters. And what can happen is if you're a lady out here, you can feel excluded from the passage of Scripture that it's not referring to you, it's not talking to you, these promises are not for you, but I want you to know they are for you. And so what we're gonna do is we'll use the word bro. And you know what? It happens today in this passage in Hebrews. We get this word again, and we'll see how it applies to all of us. So I wanna step back and I wanna look at just the overview of Hebrews, because we've stepped into a new section of the book of Hebrews. And so this is kind of just a little chart that shows us the whole book of Hebrews. And I wanna locate us where we are. So we've got an introduction. It says, God's Son speaks. And then over here in section one, we've got these four different sections that talk about Jesus being better, or Jesus being greater, or Jesus being superior. And you'll see this on the slide. You see this little arrow? This is actually a greater than sign. That Jesus is greater than everything else. But there are four particular things that the writer of Hebrews keys in on. And with each of these things, there's a danger and a warning. So you've got Jesus being superior to the angels, chapter 1 and chapter 2. We went through this for many, many weeks. That Jesus is greater, he's more superior, he's better. And not just greater in power and majesty and his godness, but also the fact that he was willing to lower himself to become human, to take on flesh, and then to become, as the writer says, the propitiation for our sin, which means he was the one who removed all of the obstacles that were in between our relationship with God and put us in a place where God's disposition towards us could be favorable. That's what propitiation means. And then the writer says, hey, be careful. Many of you are neglecting your salvation. You're neglecting Jesus and you're beginning to drift away from Jesus. And that's dangerous. And it's dangerous for many reasons, but for one huge reason at the very end of chapter 2, because Jesus is the one who can help you. Where you are, whether you're super close and you've been intimately near to Jesus, or you've been drifting, Jesus is able to help you because he's removed the obstacles that were in between you and God, and he's put you in a position where God is looking favorably towards you. And then last week, we enter into section two. And this is Jesus is superior to Moses. And he's superior to Moses in a number of different ways, as if there's a servant versus a son. The writer says, Moses is like a servant and Jesus is like a son. He's that much more superior. He said, Moses is like a house and Jesus is like the builder of the house. Jesus is so much more superior to Moses. And Moses was pretty amazing. If you look back in the history, there are only a couple guys, Moses, Abraham, David, that are looked at in the history of Israel as these incredible people. And Moses was up there. And so the writer is saying, if you look at Moses that way, if you respect Moses to this level, then Jesus is even better. He's greater. He's more superior. And then today we're going to get into a warning. There's a danger of us having a hard heart. There's a danger of us missing out on some of, if not all of, the rest that God has for us. As we move forward, we'll see that Jesus is superior to the priests, he's superior to the covenants, and the response, the conclusion is this long conclusion, chapter 11, 12, and 13. The response is that a faith response to this reality of who Jesus is and what he's done is faithfulness. That we would walk in the steps of the great men and women of faith, and they would follow their leading, and that by the power of God's Spirit inside of us, we would then in turn be faithful. But I want to look at this warning today, and in order to do that, though, we've got to get a little context. These warnings can be concerning to us. And so I've got a couple things I'm going to show you. This first is it's a chart of its, it looks at the fruit of the faithfulness of a person over time, all right? So if you see, like let's say this was my story, and if you look at my faithfulness, let's say up at the top is a lot of faithfulness, and at the bottom is not very much faithfulness. So at the very beginning, right, I come to know Jesus, I get super excited, and I mean, I'm on fire for Jesus, and I'm faithful. And then, you know, it kind of dwanes a little bit. And then, you know, for a little bit, I'm just kind of, you know, maybe this is high school over this first little plateau. And it's like, yeah, I'm into Jesus, but I'm also kind of into basketball. And I'm into, you know, wanting people to like me. And I'm into girls. And I'm into all this stuff. And then I go to college. I got a crisis of faith. And throughout my college years, it doesn't look like I'm super faithful. Right? My obedience to Jesus is not there. I'm kind of living my own way. Maybe I'm questioning. Maybe I'm concerned. Or maybe I had a great crisis in my life. Perhaps I got some sort of diagnosis that I don't know how to handle. I don't know how to deal with. And God seems distant. And so my obedience, the fruit, what you can see from the outside is that I'm not being faithful. And then something happens and I just, you know, I jump up and I start being extremely faithful. I'm being obedient. I'm praying. I'm reading the scriptures. I'm meditating. I'm memorizing. I'm coming to church. I'm participating. I'm serving. And this kind of goes up and down throughout my life and slowly raises. Now, here's what I want you to think about. If you were going to write a letter to me, right? If you were going to write a letter to me to encourage me or to challenge me, what would you say? It depends, right? It depends on when, right? If it was over here at the very beginning, you might write something, but if it's over here when I'm not being faithful, it would depend on other things. Like how are you gonna write to me then versus up when I'm super excited, I'm passionate, I'm following faithfully? It totally depends. And it doesn't just depend on when, it depends on what's going on in my heart that's causing the faithfulness or faithlessness, at least the fruit that you can see, right? Because you can't know my heart. All you can know is the fruit. All you can know is what I do. All you can know is what I say. You can't know what's inside me. And so the letter you write to me would depend on when in my life this is happening and what's behind the fruit that you're seeing. Now, let's complicate this a bit. The writer of Hebrews is not writing to a single person, although we often think he's writing just to me personally. He's writing to a community of faith. So let's look at a community of faith over time. Now, this is just a small smattering of different people in a community. But just look at this, right? Like when one person is feeling super faithful and you're seeing lots of fruit, another person, you're seeing no fruit. And it changes over time. And that doesn't even disclose the motivation of the heart. This is just what we see on the outside. So if you were a writer writing to a community that looked like this, how would you do it? A lot of times we get tripped up on the warnings in Hebrews, partly because we don't understand the context of what he's writing to. It's difficult. Imagine Renaud. 20 years from now, like he leaves Mosaic, he goes on to do, you know, I don't know, something, he becomes a professional juggler, I don't know. And then later on, 20 years from now, he writes a letter to Mosaic Church. If someone were to write a letter just to this group of people, in here we have 1,000 different stories. In here we have 1,000 different journeys. In here we have 1,000 different reasons for why we are at where we are in the journey. It's difficult to write. And if you're going to challenge because you're seeing that there are some people in this community who have fallen away from Jesus in their fruit, who are neglecting their salvation and drifting away from the way of Jesus in their obedience, their fruit, and you're wondering, how do I write and speak to their heart? It's going to be a little bit difficult. And in the same way, the writer of Hebrews, he writes these warnings to an entire community of people. And they're a mixed bag, right? All over the spectrum, depending on where in time he's writing. And so when we read these warnings, we need to read them to a community of people. And we need to read them based on another person looking at the fruit of faithfulness. Does that make sense? Can't know the heart. Looking at the fruit and trying to encourage the heart and challenge the heart wherever the heart is for a multitude of people to draw near to Jesus. Because what Jesus has for us is an opportunity to enter into his rest, to experience the beauty and fullness of all that he has for us in the future for sure, but also some of it now. And so he's writing, and he gives these strong warnings. So let's turn to this passage of scripture. This passage is in chapter three, starting in verse 6, the second half of verse 6. Now, if you can't read this all the way back, I'm so sorry, but we had to get it all on the page so that you could see how connected it is. This entire passage is incredibly connected. And if you don't see it and all the connections, you will misunderstand this warning. So let's start at the very beginning. Let's just read through it. It says, "We are his house." We, his church, we are his, Jesus's house, God's house, if indeed we hold fast our confidence and boasting in our hope. Therefore, as the Holy Spirit says today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts, as in the rebellion. This is a quote from Psalm 95. On the day of testing in the wilderness, where your fathers put me to the test. This is God speaking, looking back on the Israelites' time in the wilderness. And saw my works for 40 years. Therefore, I was provoked with that generation. Therefore, I was provoked with that generation and said, they always go astray in their heart. They have not known my ways. As I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. Take care, brothers. And sisters, or bros, take care, bros. All of you, take care, bros. Lest there be in any of you an evil, unbelieving heart, leading you to fall away from the living God. But exhort or encourage or challenge one another every day, as long as it is called today, that none of you may be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. For we have come to share in Christ, if indeed we hold our original confidence firm to the end. As it is said, today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion. For who were those who heard and yet rebelled? Was it not all those who left Egypt led by Moses? And with whom was he provoked for 40 years? Was it not with those who sinned, whose bodies fell in the wilderness? And to whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest? But to those who were disobedient. So we see that they were unable to enter because of unbelief. Now there's a lot there. And what we need to do is a little background before we enter into this. And we need to look back at the Old Testament
in the book of Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers and understand what was going on with these people led out of Egypt by Moses. Who were these people? What were they doing? What were they like? Because he gives a pretty harsh report about these people. So what I did is I put together a little bit of information for us so we can see what were they like. And what you're gonna notice as we look at all of this is there's stuff in white and stuff kind of in gray with little stars. The stuff in gray with little stars is Israel's rebellious response, okay? So you're gonna see kind of a pattern emerging. We've got the Red Sea crossing, right? Israel is at the edge of the Red Sea and Pharaoh's army is coming to destroy them, and God supernaturally parts the waters and they walk through the Red Sea on dry ground with water on either side of them. They go through, Pharaoh's army comes after them, and the waters come crashing in and God saves them. Who here thinks that would be pretty impressive? Anybody think that after that you might think, I don't know if God's real? Anyone? Probably. I mean, it seems like it's pretty obvious, right? Let's look at their response. A few days later, they grumble in the wilderness of sin. I love the titles they give to these places because they're sinning against God, so they call it the wilderness of sin. They grumble against God. They're like, we don't have any food. And then God, he provides manna and quail for them supernaturally. So every morning they get manna, which is bread just on the ground that they can pick up and take and eat. And then at night he brings in quail for them to have meat. So they got bread and meat morning and night. Then they quarrel with Moses at Rephidim because they don't have any water. And they're like, why'd you bring us out of Egypt? It was better there. And then God provides water for them supernaturally through a rock. Now, if God had just supernaturally provided water from you from a rock, would you think, it was a trick? What about after having this morning eaten manna, you didn't do anything for it, just showed up, and then the night before you had some quail, and then there's water coming out from a rock, and you just seen the Red Sea parted on both sides, think, I don't know. I don't know about God. Is he real? And yet, what do you see? Then God gives victory against Amalek for them. Then Israel agrees with God at Sinai in the terms of the covenant. And then Israel confirms the covenant, says, yes, God, we promise we will obey the covenant. We see the terms that you've given us. We are in, we're good, we're gonna obey. And then right after that, Israel rebels with the golden calf. Just a few days later, right? Moses is up on Mount Sinai. They're like, man, he's taking so long. With the strength that I have from the manna I ate this morning and the quail last night, I'm gonna rebel and make a golden calf. Right? Think about the golden calf, right? They're taking their gold, they're putting into a fire, they're worshiping this golden calf with the strength that they had from the bread that they ate supernaturally from God this morning and the quail they ate last night. It doesn't make a lot of sense, does it? And we see this continue over and over. In fact, we see more and more rebellion from Israel as they go forward, right? Moses intercedes and God forgives. Then God renews the covenant with Israel. Then Israel leaves Sinai and they complain. Israel decides to go back to Egypt. This is a good one. Finally, they get up to the promised land and 12 spies go out into the land. And they come back and 10 of them are like, hey, land is fantastic. It's great. It's beautiful. Everything that we could ever want, except there's all these giants. You know how giants are. I don't think we're going to make it. And so the whole congregation says, fine, we are not going to enter the promised land. They try and choose for themselves a new leader to lead them back to Egypt. They finally say, God, no, we will not enter the promised land. Doesn't go super well. They decide to go back to Egypt. Moses then intercedes and God forgives them. And then Israel goes against God's decree, Numbers 14. Korah then in Numbers 16 incites a rebellion. Israel assembles against Moses in Numbers 20. And then God provides water through rock again in Numbers 20. And there's more stuff to go. This is just all that I could fit on this slide. But if you look at the general disposition of the nation of Israel towards God, is that God is continually faithful and they are continually faithless. That God continually provides in great generosity and then they grumble. God, takes care of their enemies and then they complain. God intercedes for them and forgives them and then they rebel. Over and over and over to the point where they finally say, actually, God, we will not enter your rest. We will not enter the promised land. We are going back to Egypt and we are going to get a leader for ourselves to take us back to Egypt. Now, in light of that, as we look at this passage again, it makes a little bit more sense. Now, I'm just going to be totally honest with you. When I look at the people of Israel in the wilderness, I judge them. I do. I think, really? Part of the Red Sea? Every day, God is supernaturally feeding you. You don't do anything for it. God provides victory over your enemies. He provides water supernaturally from a rock twice. I mean, how many people get that twice in their life? Like, I haven't had that once in my life. They got it twice. And you just think, like, really? That's your response to God? And I have a pretty hard heart towards those people. I think that would not have been me. That's not how I would have reacted. That's not how I would have lived. That's not how I would have done it. And I look at them and I judge them pretty hardcore. Now, I think most of us are in the same boat. Some of us have much better hearts than I do. And bless you. I love that. Can we be friends? But I think most of us are kind of in that boat. Think about the people who were receiving this letter from the Hebrews. The writer of Hebrews, the author. Like, they know these stories and they look at them the same way. They judge them the same way we do. And so the writer of Hebrews is going to use those people that we judge to shine a mirror up to us, to our hearts and our minds. And it's not pretty. What we see is that over time, they were faithless. And if you look at all the stuff in yellow, and particularly the stuff that I underlined in black, this is what faithlessness looks like, right? They put God to the test, meaning God continually showed him his power, his kindness, his grace, his generosity, which, by the way, we think that should change you. That should impact you. When you look at all of the supernatural, kind, generous things God did, you should probably respond in obedience and belief. But they put God to the test. They didn't. They continued said, God, I'm thirsty. Why'd you bring me here? Rather than saying, hey, God, we believe that you can provide water, especially the second time after they saw it the first time. They continually go astray. It says here they always go astray. This word could also be continually. I think the idea is it's a pattern that their life continually they go astray. They don't intimately know God and his ways. They have an unbelieving heart that is causing them to fall away. They are being hardened in their heart by the deceitfulness of sin. They're living in sin, and that sin then is having another effect in their heart, making it harder and harder over time. They heard what God said, and yet they rebelled. They saw, and yet they rebelled. They sinned. They were disobedient. And all of this is classified as the fruit of unbelief. See, right here in the ending, it says, see, they were not able to enter because of unbelief, right? Belief is the thing. But what does unbelief look like? What does belief look like? And the writer of Hebrews shows us very clearly what unbelief looks like. It looks like the Hebrews, the Israelites in the wilderness for 40 years, continually, at every turn, rebelling, not having faith, not trusting. And at the end saying, yeah, we're not gonna go where God wants us to go. That's the fruit of unbelief. Now, it says something here, and I think it's important to really look at the context. God says, he swore in his wrath, they shall not enter my rest. Now, it's important to be wary of God's wrath. But at the same time, we need to look at it in the context. Okay, so this is the picture of God's wrath for the Israelites who continually over 40 years showed consistent unbelief, right? This is his wrath. He said, you won't enter my rest. What was his rest? The promised land, right? They said, you won't enter the promised land. Now there's a couple things that we need to see here. Not only did God say, you're not gonna enter the promised land, but what he did not do is he did not send them back to Egypt. Now, this is huge. First of all, who decided they wouldn't enter the promised land first? The people. The people said, we're not gonna go. We're gonna get a new leader. We're gonna go back to Egypt. And what God's wrath looked like was that in God's wrath, he said, yeah, you're not gonna enter the promised land, but I'm not gonna let you go back to Egypt because Egypt is worse than the wilderness. You were enslaved there. You were abused there. You were mistreated there. Your children were murdered there. And even in my wrath, even though you're not gonna enter the promised land, I'm gonna keep you in the wilderness and not let you go back to Egypt because Egypt is far worse. And in fact, over the next number of years that you're in the wilderness, I'm gonna continue to provide food for you every single day. Manna in the morning, quail at night. I'm gonna continue to fight for you against your enemies. I'm gonna continue to forgive you. I'm gonna continue to be God and be faithful because I will not deny myself. So in God's wrath, it's easy to say, man, that's harsh. He wouldn't let him enter the promised land. But first of all, they said, we're not gonna enter the promised land. And second of all, God said, I'm gonna continue to provide for you and protect you from the place that you really wanna go, which is even worse. So we look at the character of God, and even in God's wrath, he's generous. Even in his wrath, he's kind. Even in his wrath to the people in Israel, he's gracious. Right? I mean, it blows my mind to look at what God did, who God is, how that reflects his character. It's incredible. Now, what is the other side of this? What's the other side of this? This faithfulness. We're his house if indeed we hold fast to our confidence and boast in our hope. Today, do not harden your heart, but exhort one another every day as long as it's called today. If we have come to share in Christ, if indeed we hold our original confidence firm to the end, do not harden your hearts. Now, when we look at the opposite of faithlessness and the encouragement of the writer of Hebrews to faithfulness, it can be a little scary, right? Because he says this old thing, firm to the end, right? It's like, that concerns me. Does that mean if I don't hold my confidence firm to the end, I'm in trouble? Now, there's a couple things here. We're gonna do this for 2 weeks. This week, we're gonna look at this passage of scripture and how the writer of Hebrews handles this question. And it's incredible, it's beautiful. Next week, we're gonna do a holistic, biblical theology of assurance of salvation, right? Can I lose my salvation? We're gonna look deeply into that question. Spoiler alert, no, but we're gonna look at it. Next week, Renaud's gonna come. He's gonna do an unpacking of this, a biblical, theological unpacking of this question. But today, we're gonna look at it from the perspective of the writer of Hebrews, how he wrestles with this with the people. And so if there's any questions, make sure you come back next week because we're gonna look at this. But here's what he does, and it's really beautiful. So the stuff in pink, we have this contrast. If you look at the things that are circled, the things that are underlined versus what is highlighted? I don't know. It's lit. You see a difference, right? The things that are underlined or circled, you've got 40 years, you've got an entire generation, you've got always or continually, you've got 40 years, and then you've got the verdict or the reality that those who fell in the wilderness, right? What the writer of Hebrews is doing, he's taking the long game. And he's looking at the entirety of what happened in the past, looking at their fruit, looking at the results of their fruit, and pronouncing a verdict over them. Where God can at any given point in time pronounce a verdict over someone, because God sees the beginning from the end, or the end from the beginning. He sees it all. He's in all. And as we look more deeply into this, he's at work through it all. But I love what the writer does. he contrasts these long-term things with a present reality that we should focus in on. And we'll see this. Now, there's a couple of things that I want us to see. And they're just, I put them in a couple sentences that I think are very important, that are going to be helpful for us. First, I can have assurance of my salvation based on my faith, right? The verdict was unbelief or belief, right? That's the deal, right? God saw Abraham's faith and he credited it as righteousness. I can have assurance of my salvation based on my faith. Like I know my heart, I know my mind. You don't. So I can have confidence. I can only have confidence in your salvation based not on your faith, because I can't know your faith, but based on your fruit, right? I can have assurance of my salvation based on my faith, but I can only have confidence in yours based on your fruit, because I don't know your heart. One day, Paul writes that God will reveal the intentions of the heart and he will invite us to judge with him. But right now, we don't know. And this is important as we come to these passages, is that my assurance is on my faith, but my confidence is in your fruit, right? There's a difference whether I'm looking at myself or I'm looking at other people. And then the writer of Hebrews gives us these questions. There are some questions that are unhelpful that we want to begin to ask when we think about assurance of my own salvation. Here are two unhelpful questions. Question one, have I followed Jesus faithfully every day? This is looking at the past. That's unhelpful. Another question, will I follow faithfully every day? This is a question about the future, also unhelpful. We're gonna talk about why. The question that is helpful is this, am I looking to Jesus today? Right, you look at the writer of Hebrews, his solution that he gives is today, today, today. Over and over and over, he pushes us to look at today. Here's why the first question is unhelpful. Right, if I look at salvation according to my past, I'm gonna live in despair because I can't fix the past. I can't do anything about the past. Or I might have false hope because I'll look at all the things I did and I'll think, and maybe I'll look at all the things I did compared to all the things you did, and I'll be like, I'm killing it. I'm doing great. Because the way that I judge myself versus the way that I judge you, it's very different. Because I know the motives of my heart and I don't know the motives of your heart, right? That can produce despair or false hope. If I look at salvation through the lens of my future, that can produce a lot of fear. Because I don't know the future. I don't know what's gonna happen. I don't know what I'll choose. And if I'm honest about my past, it's been a mixed bag of faithfulness and faithlessness, and I don't know what's gonna happen in the future. That could produce fear. But if I look at salvation in terms of my present through the lens of Jesus's past, his death and his resurrection, and Jesus's future, his imminent return, then God can give me hope. He can give me confidence. When I look at my salvation in the present, today, am I looking to Jesus today, but through the lens of Jesus's past, what he did on my behalf on the cross and his resurrection and his future return, that he's coming back to get me, that can produce hope and confidence. That if I am looking to Jesus today, or as the writer of Hebrews says, not hardening my heart towards Jesus today, then I can have confidence that if I'm looking to Jesus now, he is drawing me near to himself. We looked at this 3 weeks ago in the book of John, chapter 6, 35 and 40. I can have confidence that if I'm looking to Jesus now, that God will finish the work that he started. Philippians 1:6. I can have confidence that if I'm looking to Jesus now, that that good work is evidence of the faith that God born in me at the first day I began to follow Jesus. How incredible that our God in his kindness doesn't define me by my past or the mysteries of my future and let them own me, but instead he defines me by Jesus's past. What he did, his life, his death, his resurrection on my behalf, becoming the propitiation, the person who made the payment that removed the things, the obstacles in the way of my relationship with God and put me in a position where God would be favorable towards me. That's how I'm defined. And my future is guaranteed Because if he started it, he's gonna finish it. If he died and he rose and did the hard work of that, then of course he's gonna come back and return and bring me home. How kind of God that he would do things this way for us. What a generous God. See, the writer of Hebrews, as he brings forward this challenge, this warning, he says, what you do is today. Today, allow God to soften your heart towards him. Participate with God's Spirit in softening your heart today. Don't be consumed by your past. Don't be consumed by your future. Today, right now, in this moment, wherever you are in the spectrum of this journey of belief and this journey of faithfulness and the journey of fruit, wherever you are, all of us, no matter we feel like we've been super faithful or we've been running from God or maybe we're just lukewarm, no matter where we are, the solution is right now, today, look to Jesus. Because if you're looking to Jesus, he's drawing you to himself. And you can have confidence and assurance in your present and future salvation. Look to Jesus today. And like the writer of Hebrews is doing, surround yourself with a community of people who will challenge you, who will warn you, who will say, hey, I'm looking at your fruit and I'm nervous. The fruit that I see in your life concerns me that you're not experiencing God's rest, that the deceitfulness of sin is hardening your heart. Put those people in your life who will speak truth to you, because that truth will set you free. Because Jesus wants more for us. And no matter where we are, no matter how much fruit of faithfulness we're demonstrating, we can always hear a little bit of a challenge. And so, take a deep breath. That's a lot. Here's what I want us to do. I want us to take a moment and sit in that challenge. We don't do this a lot at Mosaic. What we like to do most of the time is look at the perfect finished work of Jesus and just celebrate all that Jesus has done. But sometimes it's important that we actually sit in the challenge, in the warning. All of us need to hear it in one way or another. No matter where we are, we all need to hear it, right? Because the writer of Hebrews looks at his audience and says, in some ways, you're reminding me of the people of Israel that you judge in the wilderness. And in some ways, many of us, if not all of us, look a lot like the nation of Israel. Probably not exactly, but to some degree, there are places in our heart that have become hard. There are places in our mind and our heart where we have some disbelief or some unbelief. There's some places where sin is in our life, where there is sinful desires that are guiding us to live out in sinful ways. And we need to hear this challenge. Because although I don't believe your salvation is in jeopardy, I do believe that the deceitfulness of sin will continually harden your heart. And at the very least, you won't experience some of the fullness of the rest that God has for you now. The life that God has for you now. You'll experience the death consequences of sin. And I don't want that for you. Just like the writer of Hebrews said, I don't want that for myself. And I tell you what, I've had to sit in this challenge and it's been good for me. I've needed it. I've really needed it because there were some things that needed to change. Here's how Jesus, when he writes a letter to a church in the book of Revelation, here's how he says this, what I think is helpful. He says, I know your works. You are neither cold nor hot. I would that you were either cold or hot. So because you are lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will spit you out of my mouth. And here's the reasoning he gives. What does this mean? He says, for you say, I am rich. I have prospered. I need nothing. Not realizing that you are wretched, pitiable, poor, blind, and naked. Here's the reason why many of us need to hear the challenge, the warning, and sit in it a little bit today. Because we think we're fine. I think I'm good to go. maybe if I look at my recent past and I think, I've been killing it. I've been doing a great job. And especially if I look at all of you, I'm really doing a great job. And what Jesus says is you think you're rich. You say you need nothing, but what you don't understand is the full reality that you're pitiable, poor, blind, naked, that you are in deep, desperate need of me, that you think you're fine, but you've actually begun to neglect Jesus and you've begun to drift from him, that your heart is becoming hard, that there's unbelief stirring in you and it concerns me. Now, what I want us to do is I want to sit in this with God's Spirit. Because if we sit in this by our own wisdom, there are those of us who will think, I'm doing fine, even though maybe there's some conviction that's needed. And there's some of us who have a really loud inner critic that will think, I'm the worst, I'm always the worst, I'm never doing anything right, I'm the worst. And for both of us and anywhere in between, we need God's Spirit to do the convicting. Because if you feel a finger pointing at you, that's the adversary. He's the accuser. That's not Jesus. He's our advocate. If you feel shame, that's not Jesus. If you feel condemnation, that's not God. If you feel conviction. And conviction is like a good hurt. It's like a, I need it. It's like the soreness you get when you do a good workout. It's a good hurt. It's a good pain. You feel it here. It's like, yeah, I needed that. That's true. That's real. But it's done in love, in kindness, wooing you into better. So let's just take a moment. Just take a deep breath. And just in your own heart and mind, just ask God, God, would you allow this warning to sit in me in the way that you want it to? Would you reveal the things that you want to reveal? Where I've begun to drift, where I've begun to neglect, where there's hardness in my heart, where there's unbelief. God, we ask that you, by the power of your Spirit, in each of our hearts and minds, you just reveal what you want to reveal. You would encourage where you want to encourage. You'd challenge where you want to challenge. You'd inspire where you want to inspire. But I pray that we would not quickly move past this warning and miss out on some of the gift that it is for us as a community. Spirit of God, speak. Whatever comes to your mind, just hold it. If it feels like shame, discard it. If it feels like condemnation, let it go. But if it feels like conviction, if it's a good hurt as the reality of where you're actually at is presented before you, hang on to that. That's good. That's from God. I just encourage you, whatever came up, I just confess it to God. Just say, God, this is where I am. This is the reality. If we confess our sin, he is faithful and just to forgive us of our sin and cleanse us from all unrighteousness. Just say, God, yes, this is the reality. I have fallen short of the glory of God. There is some unbelief in my heart. There is some hardness in my heart. I have begun to drift. Just acknowledge it. Say, God, this is where I am. I confess that to you. God, I pray against shame and condemnation right now as your Spirit does his work. I pray for the confidence that you would give us to be able to be honest in your presence, in the presence of a holy God within our community of faith. And I pray that we would know that your throne is a throne of grace for us because Jesus is our advocate, that there is no condemnation. And that if we confess, you are faithful and you are just to forgive us and cleanse us from all unrighteousness. God, would you do that right now? Cleanse us. The writer of Hebrews says, today. Don't harden your heart today. Allow God to soften your heart today. Wherever you are, wherever you've been on the spectrum, allow God to soften your heart. I'm gonna go out on a limb here and just give an opportunity that we don't give often. We've done this before, but we don't often do this. But
If you're here and there was just a just an overwhelming amount of conviction and you just want some extra prayer, I just encourage you to just stand right now. I know it's kind of scary because people can see you, but just know that this week, this is where I've been. Just if there was just some extra and you want some more prayer, you want some community surrounding you praying for you, just stand right now. Just say, this is where I am. Thank you. Thank you for being brave. Thank you. How encouraging it is to see people being honest. Thank you. We're going to respond in worship. And what we're going to do is we're all going to stand. And if you are near someone who is standing right now, I just ask you to pray for them. Don't pray that God would begin doing a work. He's already doing a work because they were willing to stand, right? He's already working. He's already doing stuff. But just affirm them. Say, God, continue this. Say, God, thank you for their bravery, for their honesty, for their willingness, because what we need is a community of Jesus followers surrounding us, encouraging us to look to the Lamb. Pray that they would continue to look to Jesus because he is our salvation right now, a present help in times of trouble. We're gonna sing a song called Look to the Lamb. And it's just a community singing to one another, look to Jesus, look to the Lamb, the perfect sacrificial Lamb. And in the bridge, it starts talking about the way that Jesus looks in Revelation. It's a little odd, but it's beautiful because it's an aspect of the way that Jesus looks in the fullness of his holiness. And I just encourage you to sing out with all of your heart for yourself, but also for our community, encouraging, challenging, inspiring each other to look to Jesus right now, because that is the solution to wherever you've been, no matter what last night looked like or this morning looked like. Let's go ahead and stand and let's respond and sing, look to the Lamb. Jesus, thank you for the honesty, the confidence that you've given people to be honest, to stand up and to say, hey, I need prayer, I need help. God, come alongside them. Continue the work that you're already doing in their heart and their mind through our community of faith, encouraging them to look to the Lamb with everything they are, because you, Jesus, are able to help now.